This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'll be getting an overview on intellectual disabilities from Dr. Mark Lovell, consultant child and adolescent learning disability psychiatrist with Tees, Esk and Weir Valleys NHS Foundation Trust and family carer advisor Mary Busk. Mary is on NHS England's Improving Health and Quality team and part of the Learning Disability Programme, and Mark has written the ACAM topic guide on intellectual disabilities. Hello, both of you. Mary and Mark, can you start by introducing yourselves and give some details about your roles?
Okay, so my name is Mark Lovell. I'm a consultant child and adolescent learning disability psychiatrist. So I was trained as a child psychiatrist as well as a learning disability psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And I sit on the board of ACAM as the lead for CPD and have a variety of roles within child intellectual disability, mostly within psychiatry, so nationally through the Royal College of Psychiatrists, the Child and Adolescent Intellectual Disability Psychiatry Network, and have given various bits of advice over time to NHS England, Health Education England, Public Health England, to name a few.
Okay. And Mary Busk, I'm a family carer advisor. Last year I was employed by NHS England as a family carer advisor, along with another parent. Before that, I was involved in setting up the National Network of Parent Carer Forums, which is a pan-England group of family carers across all disabilities with the aim of influencing and improving services for all children and young people with disabilities, including learning disabilities and their families. And I'm here today speaking as a family carer in a personal capacity.
And I guess a question to each of you, how did you come to specialise in this particular field? So perhaps Mark, do you want to start?
For me, it kind of started in childhood, really. My father was a youth leader working mostly with individuals with disabilities within sort of, so all my ski trips as a child were with people with of a whole variety of disabilities, sort of either physical or sort of, at the time, it was known as sort of handicaps. Mm-hmm. The terminology has changed now. And my mum worked as a French teacher part-time, but mostly in today centres. So all of my holidays were sat at the back of French classes with people sort of whisking by in wheelchairs and various other things. So for me, it was just part of normal life. And then when I decided I wanted to go into psychiatry, I wanted to do child psychiatry. And then as soon as I got into child psychiatry, I wanted to sub-specialise further again into intellectual disabilities and autism, which is what I've ended up doing as a career, really.
Okay. And Mary, how about you?
I had to become interested and specialise when my second child was born, and from a very young age realised that he had a range of needs in relation to his development and behaviour that I found very hard to get answers to in my local area. So I started to read around and came across things like the National Services Framework for Children and Young People, and became quite interested in how services are commissioned and how it was that there were difficulties in getting needs identified and getting our children, my son, the right help.
Before we move on, I think it's really important. You're going to give an overview on intellectual disabilities, but can you say something about the term intellectual disabilities? Because I think a lot of people are more familiar with the term learning disability.
Yeah, I guess the terms have changed over time, and the difficulty with many things is that words become pejoratives and insults. So in the past, you know, moron, idiot, stupid, cretin were all forms of learning disabilities or conditions linked to them, and they get used as horrible terms. Yeah. And we move on and we move on and we move on, and things moved on to mental retardation, which has then become an insult in its own right. particularly in the States, less so within Europe. But we then moved on to learning disabilities as a term, but it didn't link in nicely with the classification systems out there. And gradually over time, particularly from a professional perspective, professional groups have started moving towards using intellectual rather than learning, mm-hmm. mostly because, one, that's how we assess. It is based upon IQ points, which are points linked to levels of intellect. Also, many people are perfectly able to learn new things and new skills, or learn in different ways, where it's their intellect that has been impaired, not necessarily their learning mm-hmm. for certain things. And I think internationally, the words have all got muddled up over time, and trying to come up with a common language has led to intellectual disabilities becoming the preferred term, particularly in the newer iterations of international classifications. So we've moved to intellectual developmental disorder and disorder of intellectual development as the new terms going forward from an international perspective. So we know that sort of the psychologists at the British Psychological Society have moved over to intellectual disability, and the psychiatrists have done the same, and they are the two main groups that make diagnoses within this group. So that's how we've got to intellectual disability as a term amongst professionals, but that is certainly different to how things, the words that are used elsewhere. So maybe Mary could talk a little bit about sort of preference on words within sort of parents and carers.
Parents, yes. I mean, I'm obviously here today talking as a family carer, giving my own views, but certainly I'm very aware that families and people, I think, have not really been involved in the decisions that have been taken by the international bodies. And in the filtering down of this information can take a long time to people and families. So I think there's also a grave concern about everybody having very high aspirations for children, young people and adults with a learning disability, and concerns about how the use of language or different language might impede that or imply that in any way, you know, these people cannot achieve and have really good lives. So certainly, you know, among people like myself, we do like the term learning disability. That's a term that's widely used, and I think it's unclear, just being totally honest, about how this language will sort of reconcile itself in relation to people and families and how they are going to, you know, get to know about all of this.
Who falls within the criteria of having an intellectual disability? And I know there are different levels of severity, so perhaps you can sum up each of those.
So an intellectual disability is roughly the bottom 2% of the population in terms of IQ, though it also has to have significant difficulties with what we call adaptive behaviours, which are pretty much your behaviours of daily living, and they can be anything from getting dressed and making your own breakfast to looking after your hygiene, to planning, to using clocks and time and a whole variety of life skills. But those also have to be down in the bottom roughly 2% of the population's abilities. Then you get into the intellectual disability range, and it's broken down into four main areas. So there's mild, moderate, severe, profound. And at each of these levels, you are effectively more disabled and you have a lower IQ at each point. So mild, the biggest contention is possibly between the two main classification systems, because an IQ of 70 and below is counted as an intellectual disability in the US system.
Right.
However, it's 69 and below if you use the world system. So depending on which system you use, there may be an IQ point difference, which can make a massive difference to what service you receive.
Wow.
So it's really important to know whether they're talking about 70 and below or below 70. But a mild intellectual disability, you will be delayed. And roughly by about the age of 16, you'll probably be about 5 years behind academically mm-hmm. by 16. and maybe 2 years behind or more by the start of school. Then you go down to moderate, and at that point, by the time you get to adulthood, you may be functioning at sort of a 6 to 9 year old level. So the word sort of mental ages isn't used anymore. We sort of talk about developmental levels or academic levels, because we're quite used to thinking academically about people, where they are functioning at academically. But we also have to bear in mind that these individuals have more life experience. It's not just about being like a 6 to 9 year old child. You may be like a 6 to 9 year old child academically, but you've had 15, 16, 17, 18 years of experience. So it is not the same as being mentally at those ages. So we've got to be quite careful about the words we use. If you then go down to severe levels of intellectual disability, it is expected that you're going to require continuous support. You may get to a functional sort of age or developmental stage of about a 3 to 6 year old by the time you're an adult. And you have to remember, this is over 18 years, and it is not a linear process. You don't just go up. You know, it can go in fits and starts. Your development may not follow a very clear trajectory, but it will plateau off. And then profound intellectual disability, you will often be pre-verbal, so not able to talk. You will require lifelong support for most, if not all, of your activities of daily living. And often sort of formal IQ testing isn't possible at those levels, because you have to be able to move your hands, you have to be able to communicate for a lot of the sorts of tests. But those are the four levels in a nutshell.
Right. How soon typically in a child's life is he or she identified as having an intellectual disability? And I suppose a follow-on question from that is, who normally picks up on this? Is it the parent? Is it health visitors? GPs, nursery school staff, paediatricians?
I think in the main, it starts off with parents noticing that something is not quite right when they're comparing their child with other children. Mm-hmm. Though we do know that some parents don't identify those things or expect their child to catch up. So there may be a delay in thinking through a child's development, mm-hmm, and the stages, and whether they are behind in any of their skills. Ideally, this would happen sort of pre-school through nursery and other settings, where to think through what's required in the future. Though I know of plenty of examples where children haven't been identified until their late teens,
well, okay,
or even into adulthood.
From a parent's point of view, maybe Mary, you can talk about this. For new parents, particularly if it's your first child, it's hard to know what to expect developmentally. What's normal? Is my child just a little bit behind? And there's probably that optimism that things will normalise. So is there some sort of telltale sign that a parent should look for that might prompt them to seek help?
Yes, I think there are, certainly at the more severe end, profound intellectual disability, learning disability, and severe learning disability, in particular if there are also other comorbid conditions like autism, that would be apparent fairly early on in a child's life. Certainly for my own son, in his case, we were aware when he was about 6 months old. Mm-hmm. So he did not indicate socialisation in relation to, you know, waving and those early developmental things that I think a lot of parents, you know, take great delight in when their children do that. And there are other signs that, where the terminology is about things in relation to development, like joint attention. And these are things that we sort of take for granted with children who don't have developmental disabilities like this. And that all sort of leads to positive early communication, the ability to learn and concentrate. So I think that Mark's right. It's often parents who will realise that things are not quite right and then will seek help, usually through the health visitor or the GP, because to get to things like paediatricians and child development centres, you have to get a referral. Mm-hmm. The issue then will be, which is something that we found, for example, the extent to which the GP understands child development In our case, he admitted afterwards he didn't know a lot about child development and was very sorry, because it took us a very long time to get any answers. And obviously that has a huge impact, because if you don't have any answers and your child can't concentrate or speak or learn or even sit down and, you know, concentrate, then when they're going into, you know, pre-nursery, that made that very difficult for our son. He couldn't really go to those things. Nursery, we were very concerned about the fact that, you know, that he needed a huge amount of support, and where would that support come from? So we already had a child, an older child in the school, and we had to tell them, we have another child who's coming, but he's going to need a lot of help. We know that, and how can we get the help?
So essentially you felt quite alone, so the professionals weren't really...
No, we didn't have anybody so who was listening to us. We didn't know what to do, other than we knew that he needed help. And I think it's then the other side of it is, you know, coming to terms with, you know, having a child whom we've loved very much, but was going to have labels attached to them that, you know, society and people would perhaps perceive in a very negative way, and might also imply or think that, you know, our son could not achieve, you know, and be, you know, have a, be valued and have a really good life. So yes, we were really struggling around ourselves, and had to get into all sorts of not very nice things, like paying for private speech and language therapy and going to tribunals with SEND and the local government social care ombudsman. And it's not somewhere we expect to have to find ourselves.
Has that improved now, do you think, or are parents in the same situation?
I think it depends. It varies probably, you know, from area to area, on how the local pathways are designed to pick up these needs and, you know, concerns through GPs, and what the pathways are to refer into child development centres and other places. Certainly I would say, in my own perspective on my own son, as he's got older, I can't see that things have improved enough to make his life positive and our lives positive. So there's a huge amount that still needs to be done, which I think is significant that, you know, NHS England has announced that learning disability and autism are going to be clinical priorities. And personally, from a parent perspective, I can see why that needs to be the case.
It sounds like it's important to get the diagnosis right as a means to get access to help. Why is it so important to get the diagnosis right?
From a professional's perspective, it's really important, because it makes a difference to what services you may receive within mental health and learning disability services, within social care. If you get the wrong diagnosis, either you're identified as having an intellectual disability when you don't have one, or where you aren't identified as having one when you do have one, that can have massive implications in terms of what you may receive in terms of benefits. So it can affect money going into families. It can also affect access for other people. Say, for instance, if you identify as having an intellectual disability and were given all the care and support that was linked to that, in today's society with austerity and there is only a finite amount of money, that might be another child that does have an intellectual disability that does not get as much service.
It's really important for a family to know what the diagnoses are, and also to be really clear and understand this issue about difference between health terminology and education terminology. So I've spent a lot of time myself, you know, understanding that, because it's important that we know what support, you know, our children and young people need. For example, how they need to be able to communicate, what we can expect in schools, what resources they will need to support their learning, and, you know, ways that we can develop, you know, their talents and be aspirational, that sort of builds on their strengths and recognises that, you know, again, as I said, you know, that everybody has value and everybody can make a contribution.
It sounds like a big ask that parents have to be the ones to learn about the different terminology between health and education. How do parents know what's available?
Well, I think with the Children and Families Act, the which has Children and Families Act 2014, which has brought together health, local areas, education, health and social care to, for example, create local offers. So that's a statutory information source for families where, you know, it should be clear to them what is available if your child has a learning disability, how you can find out about the diagnostic pathways, and, you know, understand how best to help and support our children, and, you know the right questions to ask of school and other services. I think a lot of it, we talk to other parents, we find support in sharing information. You know, I belong to, you know, groups of families. We have WhatsApp groups, we share things, and I think, you know, we learn a lot from each other. Well, my son had an eating disorder when he was very young. That was another part, a manifestation of his range of needs. And I found out about a really good feeding and eating disorder service at Great Ormond Street by talking to other parents. I found it out just by, they had been there, they said it was really good, and I then made it my ambition to make sure that my son got there so he could get the right help for his eating disorder.
Leading on from that issue of there being a variety of conditions, I think a question for you, Mark. Can you tell me about diagnostic overshadowing? What does that mean, and what challenges does it present?
Okay, so diagnostic overshadowing is where one diagnosis masks another. And a big problem with that is that it means that you're not thinking about the overall needs of a child or an adult, but you're also being quite blinkered in terms of your view about what's going on. Some of diagnostic shadowing can occur because, say, a clinician has a preference for spotting one diagnosis over another, and that can certainly happen if you're in specialist services that concentrate on one thing. And sort of commonly, there are some overlaps between various disorders that can look very, very similar in terms of the presentation you see, but have different reasons behind it. And so three neurodevelopmental conditions that massively overlap are intellectual disabilities, autism spectrum disorders, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. They can all look very similar, owing to the fact that they all lead to a variety of delays in a variety of skills.
Yes, I mean, I think just to add to that on, you know, the health need side as well, there is a huge risk of diagnostic overshadowing where health needs, you know, basic health needs like ear infections may be attributed to behaviours. And so there's a huge risk, you know, in this group of children, young people and adults, that very basic health needs will not be met or will be attributed to other things related to their diagnoses.
Even in terms of guidance and legislation, sometimes autism spectrum disorder and learning disabilities are sort of lumped together as one and the same thing. So is there a greater need for better separation and more clarity when it comes to giving recommendations for intellectual disabilities?
Well, certainly from the point of view of families and people, I would say absolutely yes, because they're two different things. The example in relation to my son's case, he has both autistic spectrum disorder and a severe learning disability, as well as, you know, the associated sensory issues that come, are understood to be part of an autistic spectrum disorder. And those, and the way they present in him, are different. So when he really struggles with, you know, and his sensory issues are very profound, you know, it's important to understand that, you know, that's his autism, and you know, it's not so much the learning disability. So if he only had a learning disability, you know, he would have particular support needs, but having both, he has more support needs.
And from my perspective, there are certainly some overlaps in the needs between the group that have autism spectrum and the group with intellectual disabilities. And some of that comes down to the fact that approximately 50% of individuals with autism spectrum or on the autism spectrum have an intellectual disability as well. Okay. And approximately a quarter of individuals with an intellectual disability have an autism spectrum disorder as well. So the overlaps are massive. However, I think it's really difficult when you combine the two groups, because you might be combining an individual with an intellectual disability that's profound. So an IQ of, say, 10, you know, is fully 100% looked after by others for every single bit of their care needs. Comparing that individual with somebody who may have Asperger's syndrome, so with an IQ of 170, who owns their own tech company that's global, it's really difficult to compare and contrast the two, but there are certainly overlaps, particularly around adaptive behaviours, but not necessarily saying that the two groups are identical.
It sounds like there's masses in the pipeline then. I mean, are there any particular areas of research that you're particularly interested in that you want to highlight?
I think for me, behavioural phenotypes are a big sort of thing at the moment, in terms of where you may have a genetic condition that presents in a certain way, sort of as a stereotype as such. And we know that for some, say in Cornelia de Lange syndrome, we know that a lot of the self-injury that occurs with that is actually due to gastroesophageal reflux. So they're having acid going up into their throat. It's giving them heartburn, and they're expressing that through self-injury, which goes back to Mary's point earlier about the importance of thinking through physical causes for things. Right. If you give them a medication that lowers down their stomach acid, you might actually help with their challenging behaviours and their self-injury. But we know that as part of Cornelia de Lange. There are other conditions that have specific sleep problems, like Smith-Magenis, where they sleep in micro-sleeps during the daytime and don't sleep at all at night, which is disastrous for a family. Because how do you function with no sleep when you have a child that only needs a few hours a day and they are functioning, but you're not? The research is just advancing in these areas. There are research groups thinking about that. The field of genetics will make a massive difference in the future. One, in terms of understanding what your child has. Two, whether it can be passed on by other members of your family. So you may actually have siblings that can pass it on that don't know about it, who would make choices themselves about what they want to do about having a family in the future. We know that there is a lot of research going on around childhood behaviours and how to manage those. A lot of that is through non-pharmacological means, around sort of using sort of adaptive behaviour analysis, so understanding the meaning behind a behaviour, and sort of positive behaviour support is a big programme that's happening in the UK.
I mean, it's obviously a hugely dynamic area, but what types of interventions do exist at the moment then?
Interventions-wise, the big interventions really are around behavioural management, and that is really being pushed by sort of thinking through about the meaning of behaviour. So is the meaning of that behaviour communication? Is it physical illness and an expression of distress? Is it mental illness and expressing the distress of mental illness? Is it about parenting style? So if you've got a child with intellectual disability and a child without an intellectual disability, it's really hard to parent them both identically. Mm. You've got to reasonably adjust. But then it means that you are offering two sets of parenting skills into one house. Two children get different parenting, and there may be some resentment within that, or some learned behaviours linked to it. And let's face it, it is not normal to parent a child with a neurodevelopmental condition. You have to adapt. You can't just pick up the average parenting book, say this is how you parent a child. There isn't a rule book for it. You have to adapt and change and require advice and support. There's a lot of research about the causation for things at the moment, but that takes a long time to filter through into interventions and treatments. And we know the average is like 17 years between a paper being published and it actually being helpful.
Wow.
And that's really hard, because all of the evidence base out there is available on the internet now to read.
I think as well, families are really interested, and it's important that there is more understanding of research around therapeutic interventions, the role of therapies, speech and language therapy, occupational therapy, physiotherapy. And it was something I was very happy to be involved in with the British Academy of Childhood Disability research prioritisation a couple of years ago. in identifying what families and practitioners felt were the research priorities that needed to make a difference. So we've started to define those. Those are being fed into the research area. Other leading researchers are, you know, working on important areas in these fields. But as Mark said, there are gaps. We in NHS England, through some work with leading researchers, have been looking at what these gaps are, and we've identified some actions that are important. And these, again, are some things that I have written about with Sue North in The Bridge, in the current edition that is available on the ACAMH website, www.acamh.org. So just to say, we need to work more with families, with people themselves, know what works, and have urgent research prioritisation for what we need to know the answers to across education, health and social care.
Mark, you've written the Intellectual Disabilities Topic Guide for ACAM. Can you give a short summary of some of the themes that you've included in this?
I think much of what's in it has been covered today. Mm-hmm. Though there are some specific resources in there that relate to a framework that I've created that's called the IDID A2H framework, which is the identification of an intellectual disability following an A2H framework. And there's a whole variety of resources linked to that, such as being able to read a short form of it or a long form. There's a talk in there, a PowerPoint talk, that should you wish to present it to somebody else, you can. There's professionals sort of data collection tools with them, so you can type the information that you've gathered from a family and their networks into a report effectively, and also a guide for parents about if your child is being assessed for an intellectual disability, what information should you bring along and why? Because that speeds it all up for a start, makes it certainly easier for the clinician and is more likely to produce a more accurate outcome for the child. And we've tried to make it as accessible to as many as possible. We certainly know that various groups out there have started using it already and are disseminating it, and are trying to put it into practice within various hospitals or within various professional networks. So we're hoping to get it out there. It is free to use, it's free to reproduce, providing you're not doing it for financial gain. But from my side, I'm just interested in people using it and feeding back how well it's gone and if there are any improvements to be made to it. The Intellectual Disabilities Topic Guide is just one of many topic guides that ACAM has either developed or are working on at the moment, covering a variety of topics. These are all available through the website at www.acamh.org.
Finally, is there anything you'd like to say that I haven't asked, or as a takeaway message for those listening to this podcast?
From my side, it's really important to identify an intellectual disability. It's also really important to identify when something else might be going on in terms of meeting a child or young person's overall needs.
I think from a family's perspective, it's really important that families are listened to and people are listened to from a very young age when they begin to indicate worries and concerns, and that they get the right help and support to enable the families to live good, positive lives without having to fight for services or not knowing what the answers are. I think it's really important as well that education, health and social care work closely together and understand the needs of these groups, as well as the data that enables them to commission well for the groups of children, adults and their families. And in order to do that, it's really essential that commissioners and people in organisations in local areas understand what a learning disability is not, including the developments in the latest international classifications, what the prevalence is, how to commission and how to support families in really positive ways. It's also essential that everybody has very high aspirations. As the Children and Families Act wants all services to have for these groups of people and their families. And in relation to that, NHS England, with 10 partners, has just launched a new initiative called Ask, Listen, Do. It recognises, and this information is available on the NHS England website, www.england.nhs.uk /ask-listen-do, recognising that currently, on the basis of our evidence, families and people with learning disability and autistic people are not listened to and heard enough, and that current systems for feedback, concerns and making complaints are not picking up and learning from what families and people have to say and need. And that includes in the way that, you know, services are commissioned, provided, and the way that they need to be supported in a person-centred way. So I would just end by commending the resources that are available to organisations to help them to do better in these areas, commissioners included, and also these are available for families, for carers, for autistic people and people with a learning disability.
Brilliant. Thank you ever so much, both Mary and Mark. You can find Dr. Mark Lovell's topic guide on intellectual disabilities on the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.